would like to start. You know, we never know how many people are coming, and I hope that everyone can be as comfortable as possible. I do apologize for lack of chairs. We need to have more, but our neighbor moved. So we don't have as many, but I think that we can create. There's some space over here, by the way, in the hallway. There are so many new people here that who Linda and I don't know. So people should introduce themselves. And please forgive me if you told me your name and I have to ask you again. But we're so happy to see so many folks. Let me just say a couple of brief words about the salon.
I'm just sorry I interrupt you and see if like we can. I know it's kind of crowded in here, but maybe there's a. 1, 2, 3 places to sit that actually are chairs. and if anybody wants to take up residence on the floor, please do, because I know there's people in the kitchen. It's going to be kind of hard to see in here, so please try to come in if you can.
Just a couple comments, and then we're going to start. The salon, as Linda and I choose to call it, we started about February of 2005, and it just grew out of our mutual passion for human rights issues, and we started off very small. We had a couple friends over to watch a documentary on the American Civil Rights Movement for a couple weeks called Eyes on the Prize, that very good documentary, and then something came up where, because I have been working in sex trafficking, and a friend of ours, Carol Harrington, was doing some the research in sex trafficking in Hungary. And then one thing led to another. My daughter is a filmmaker. She made a movie on date rape called No in the U.S., and we've shown that a few times, and various things have occurred. That I like to say that the strength of the salon is that Linda and I know so many fascinating people, like so many people in the room, so that it is not trying to wait till someone comes from abroad, but trying to engage got people in the room, I'm sure, to share their stories. As I like to say, everyone has a story to tell. And in that regard, that we had wanted to do something about the 1956 revolution, and we knew that there were just a million programs going on about the revolution, and so we wanted to look at it from a more human personal experience of how it affected the lives of everyday Hungarians who were engaged in the revolution. And through our good friend Baron Weiss, we met Galinda and Gaston. And Gaston will tell you his story. So Gaston P.
Vadas.
Vadas, yes, yes.
Vodas.
Vodas, yes, okay. And like, I'm not going to say anything about his story. I'm going to let him tell it. So just so you know, this is as much interactive as it is in presentation. People can, when it's over, feel free to stay, drink until it's gone, and just talk with folks, because I hope to be able to meet more people. Gaston.
Thank you so much. Would you forgive me if I stay seated? Is that okay? Okay. Thank you. I noticed that there is a... I'm being recorded, and it immediately reminded me of an opening, not prepared opening line, which is, "You've done nothing, you've lied, I've lied all these years." So this way, when this tape comes out, I can sound just like Gyurcsán. So you can attack me for giving you a pep talk to get off your asses and get going, and we can't do this anymore, and so on. But anyway, the reason I'm here is because I had the... I was one of 200,000 people in 1956 who left this country. In 1956, I was 12 years old. I lived in the 5th District on Vigadó tér, which then was Molotov tér. And so I left Molotov tér, and years later I came back and visited Vigadó tér. But because once again it could take its old name. But that's not the story. The amazing thing is, for me, is that over the years, images of a kid, I mean, I was 12 years old. What does a 12-year-old kid know? And you don't really realize that until you spend a lifetime being brought up a certain way in America, where we ended up, and you come back to your homeland, and you realize that the experiences that were embedded in you, the upbringing, the way of life. I was not a young kid at the age of 12. I was always out on the street because it was very safe to be out on the street for a kid. Nothing ever happened. I mean, on the way to school, I would stop, watch construction because the entire city had to be reconstructed, and I watched people work, and it was great, and every street vendor knew me, and I knew every street, and I had an incredible interest in things around me as a kid. So when I was 12 years old, and I was in something called Nopkösi, which is an extended day classroom opportunity where the kid could stay in school in the afternoon in a loose atmosphere, and they would give you some food even, and you chatted, you studied, and then by the time you got out of there, maybe your parents have gotten home from work, so you're not home alone, as we used to say, after the movie came out. And this one particular day, it was a Tuesday, the only reason I know is that Linda, my wife, recently brought up the question of what day was October 23rd, and I didn't know until recently I looked it up, because that I didn't remember, but it was a Tuesday. So I was in Nopkösi, and around 2 o'clock in the afternoon, 2:30, some kid bursts into my classroom, I mean, into the school, and said, "Hey, something is happening out there. You got to see. I mean, there are all these people on the street." So, like a bullet, I'm out there because something was happening. I mean, I was bored in the Nopkösi. So my school was at the Ötvös, which is, to give you landmarks, do you like restaurants, cafes? You know where the Central Coffee House is? Okay. You go a little bit further down in that street where you couldn't possibly back in or back out if you go the wrong way. That's where my school was. So I walk out onto the Kuru, they're not Kuru, Rakoczi, and I see all these people.
Kosutlajos.
Thank you. The American corrects me. But she's right, she knows all the streets. So I go out to Kossuth-Lajos utca and walk toward Erzsébet híd, where toward that direction, and all these people are coming out of buildings, and it was very random, and people were talking to everybody else, and in Hungary there is something innate about an idegen, somebody's a stranger. You know, you don't talk to strangers. And most certainly, you didn't talk to people during communism if you didn't have to, because you could get yourself into trouble if you said the wrong thing. So everybody's, you know, walking around like, you know, their head down. And this was very different. Everybody was sort of chatting, and I hear things like freedom, and yeah, I was confused. I'm going with the crowd toward the Petőfi statue, which is near what is now a Marriott Hotel. You know, that's that statue that's at the foot of the bridge where the church is. And by the time I got there, there were about 500, 800, maybe 1,000 people there. And people kept coming. And as I walk onto the square, I see that Sinkovics Imre, who was probably one of the best-known Hungarian movie stars and performers, whose son actually went to my mother's kindergarten, so I knew who he was being sort of hoisted up, to the Petőfi statue. And he gets up on the statue, and there's a landing there, and by that time, there were so many people that they sort of went over the tracks of the number 2 tram, so that stopped, and things like Russians go home, and this. I mean, I was absolutely astounded. I never heard anyone openly say things like that. And then all of a sudden, Shinkovich Imre started. Talpra magyar, hívja haza, itt az idő most, vagy soha. A magyarok istenére esküszünk, hogy rabok tovább nem leszünk. You don't even have to know the words. You don't even have to know the words, but I'll tell you. No. We swear by our God. Basically, what he said is that we will no longer be slaves. This was the spark poem of Petőfi Sándor during the 1848 revolution. And by the time he got to the fourth or fifth stanza, everyone was also reciting. It was fabulous. It was absolutely fabulous. And when he finished, everyone just went nuts. I mean, by this time there were brushes, there were little sorolok. Now I don't know in English. Leaflets, pamphlets handed out, which who knows where people ran off with little slogans about freedom and Russians go home and so on. And the word came that there were like 40, 50, 60,000 people getting together at the parliament. So I had to be there. So I start walking down up outside Cherayamushutsa, and you know, you go past Lanskyd, the chain bridge, and as we were walking along, the same thing happened from every side street that you could think of. People were just coming out of buildings, first just being curious, then the five people became 10, the 10, 20, and like a huge funnel, you know, from everywhere, we were funneling into the back of the parliament there. And true, it was an incredible number of people. By this time, it was 4 or 5 o'clock in the evening, started getting dusk. And by now, people are singing the hymnus, the national anthem. They're sort of getting really into it. They're demanding that the flag be taken down from the parliament with the Russian insignia in the middle. And someone wanted to hand some pamphlet to someone in the. You know, I didn't know the details. I mean, I was standing in the crowd, but you could see the activity. You could see everything happening around you, and you could hear everyone being animated. Everyone talking to everyone else. And then later, I found out that the reason it got so dark was they turned the lights off. Whoever it was, they pulled the plug on the lights, thinking that you know, if the crowd is in the dark, then would go away, maybe, I don't know. But what happened was people took their newspapers, crumpled it up into a tight thing, lit the end. They took off posters from the poster board, those round border, you know, they lit the end. And if you, I can't tell you that feeling of oneness when you see, you know, by that time, close to 100,000 people, I think, or 80,000 people. I mean, it was filled. Standing there with torches, handmade torches. The word came, there are hundreds of thousands of people on Hershek Tere. Doja Gyergyu, you know, we're at the end of Andrássy út, if you don't know it, where the huge parades used to be, and that's where the Stalin statue was, where the tribune was erected during communist events, where Rákosi Mátyás and the rest of these bastards were standing up there and saluting their own guns and own people and so on. So a number of us start walking, and the same thing happens here as happened before. As we're walking, the crowds, the little groups become bigger groups, and we're walking down the streets, and now, of course, we're chanting and asking people to come on down from the windows, join us, you know. And so we get out to about where, I guess where the museum is, Hershek Tere. And by that time, the red stars that were on the top of most buildings that were public, not public buildings, not even public, well viewable and visible buildings, had these huge red stars on them. By that time, people were on the roof, breaking these down, and they came tumbling down the street. Everywhere you could see, they were taking the red stars down. And the focal point of this mass of people that was sort of going sort of down this enormous boulevard was the statue of Stalin. And by the time we got there, it was dark, but you know there was plenty of, I mean, it was enough light from the streetlights. They tried to cut off and tumble the statue, but they first tried on the base of the feet, so it didn't work. So they started working on his boots, on his knees, and. The attempt failed at first because the rope snapped. Then someone with a sidecar went down to the shipyards and brought back steel cables, and they tied it to these huge these huge tow trucks, enormous, that could pick up a bus. And they had three or four of these enormous trucks tied to his neck and arms. And they managed with an acetylene torch to cut the back of the boot, by his knee. And the closest I come to this image was my book on Gulliver's Travels. When Gulliver is tied down by a million ropes, you know, it's on the ground, and the Lilliputians are all over him. We were the Lilliputians. And all of a sudden, this statue starts coming forward. And the crowd just becomes still for just a second. Everyone sort of took a deep breath. And that damn statue comes. And you could hear and feel the roar, the sound, everything. It took me about 10, 15 minutes to get close enough, because I was curious, close enough to see people urinate on it, kick it, punch it, spit on it. I can't tell you. I mean, the fury of the people was enormous. So now it's like 8 o'clock, and my parents don't know where the hell I am. Okay, I mean, there were no phones, no mobile phones, right? So no phones. Period. Forget about mobile phones. We had to go to my grandmother to make a telephone call because she had a phone. Saz notes on it, Saz phones. See? Yeah. I also remember the custom reupholstery service's number in New York is in Gimbel's, Bigelow 40444. Anyway. Lovely. Fast back. So I go on the side street. I better start going home. So as I'm starting home, I see a siren. I hear a siren. I see an ambulance, a military ambulance. And they take this soldier out who's on the stretcher, and they bring him into this private hospital that I didn't realize was there on the Foschler. What's it? Not the Sierra Foschler, but here. Barosheti Foschler. You know that street with the Gorky. Then it was old Gorky. Old Gorky, yes, sure. And this beautiful mansion that was a hospital for military people, which most Americans didn't know, I guess. So I said, well, what's happening? I walk up to the manager. What's happening? The shooting at the radio station. Wow. I take off toward the radio station. Well, you know, I got to see that. So by the time I get out to near, just off the off Koshutoyoshitsa there, toward the radio station, I start walking into the side street, and I realize that by now people were not in the middle of the street, but people were sort of like in doorways and along the buildings, walking on the sidewalk, and I heard popping sounds. And all of a sudden, someone grabs my arm. And it's a man about 40, and he says to me, what the hell do you, where the hell are you, do you think you're going? I said, I'm going to the radio station, and they're shooting there. He says, yes, they are shooting there, and people are getting killed. I said, you go home. that sort of brought me back down to earth. And I said, holy shit, you know, I mean, there are people dying. This is, I'm not that curious. So I start running home, and by the time I get to the corner of where Astoria is, that later on the Führer Orban used for his, organizational meeting, there were all these barricades being put up already. Now you know what my affiliation is. And so I'm running home. Now, about an hour before that, my father asks my 8-year older brother, he was a medical student at the time, who's 6'5", you gotta find Gaston, you gotta find Gaston. So, but he said this in Hungarian. Richie means junior, I was junior. So, my brother, knowing me pretty well, says, well, let's see, where's the biggest problem? He's gonna be there. So he goes over where the museum is and jumps across the fence. And as he lands in the bushes, he looks on the other side, just beyond the bushes. There are a bunch of soldiers setting up a submachine gun, you know, on the ground. So he goes, jumps back over the thing and starts running home. So as both of us were running home, and there's my father, you know, waiting in the doorway, and, you know, I didn't know whether he was going to kill me or cry or whatever, and luckily, because usually, if I did something wrong, he beat the shit out of my brother. So I figured my brother is in big trouble. But anyway, my father was really cool about it. He was so happy we were safe, you know, we went upstairs. And so I went upstairs, and that's when I gave my report to my family of what I had seen. This was the evening of the revolution for me. What I had found out since then, in recent years, was how it really got started. Because it, please believe me, no matter what anybody tells you, this was a spontaneous revolution. And no matter what anybody says, it was a spontaneous revolution. It did have some sparks, though, which the sparks that ignited it were based on the student organizations of Szeged, of Budapest, and some other universities, where they put out manifestos. They wanted to have meetings. Let's not get bogged down about details, because I'm sure that someone can shoot a hole in my timeline here, as they say. But the essence is that there was a spark given by the students. The government was not ready to take it really seriously. They said, yes, you can have a street meeting. Then they said, no, you can't. Then they wanted to have a meeting anyway. Then they wanted, you know, and it went on like that. But these papers, these manifestos, got out on the street. They got out into, and spontaneous combustion. It just went like that. So, that was, you know, I am not going to talk about what it was like between, unless you ask me to, between October 23rd and November 4th, when we basically lived in the basement to make sure that we were safe. I'd be more than happy if you want to get into details of what I saw during that period of time and what I saw after November 4th. But I do have a couple of things to say about what happened to the memory of 1956 for me. I was not emotional about 1956 all these years, but somehow 50 has something. I don't know. It was a big number. It's a half a century. So somehow I felt that a lot of people are not going to be here for the 100th anniversary of the revolution, but a lot of people are here who are here for the 50th. And for me, I wanted to feel something. I wanted to feel something special that reflected what I have just told you about, which is a spontaneous, it was a revolution. I was participating in a revolution. It was prior, I mean, I didn't end up the following days with a submachine gun or with a Molotov cocktail killing tanks and things like that. That's all part of this too. But I wanted to remember this 50th year. And what happens is that this idiotic Hungarian preoccupation with splitting the nation in half because of democracy, because we're allowed to, it hijacked. It almost, for me personally, they almost managed to hijack my memories, my ability to go out. My original plan was to go and revisit these four places and bow my head. It changed my life. It changed everything. We became refugees. We left in December. We escaped across the border with my mother. Each of us had two bags. I am one of those typical quote-unquote success stories of being a refugee, of finding a country that United States, this case, although there were many wonderful countries that did the same thing for Hungarian refugees, a country that gave me the education, the freedom to think, the freedom to become an independent individual, a country that unfortunately is changing it also, where it's taking away the freedoms, but that's another story. But it changed my, this is what gave me an opportunity to be, I think, a better, more rounded and a more intelligent individual. That's where I met my wife. How bad is that? We're still married. How many years? 37 years. Okay. So I think the way I want to finish this for the moment is that I've been writing things down, and I do want to come out with a book next year sometime of not just the story of 56, but what it was like for me to grow up in Budapest under communism, in the Rákosi period, and come from a family that somehow managed to maintain civility, was lucky enough not to be evicted from the apartment. We managed to stay there even though we were not jókáder, which means if you're not the proper credentials, you could be someone who take your apartment or house or whatever, and they take you someplace with no electricity or whatever, put you in one room, and that's where you work. But at any rate, there were good things too. I have incredible memories of the summer harvest in the countryside, but the entire village in Nógrádbér, where we used to spend summers, where how that all happened and how people, there were beautiful memories of my childhood, even though it was communist era. So you can find the good. I feel that without my Hungarian base and Hungarian soul, I wouldn't be a complete person. But with my Hungarian birth and my basis and belief that America offered to me, made me a more complete person. And I feel that it's absolutely imperative that I do everything I can to make sure that in this country or in America, that true democracy is maintained, that the minority does not have a right to dictate the majority, and that there would be parliamentary procedures that are maintained, and civility. Democracy is a long, long process, and I think we must try it. We must absolutely try it, and we must insist that those people who always say no, 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 that's not right, that's not right, that they say what is right and what they are willing to agree in or with. Because I guarantee you that if you say to the other side, say, look, as bad as it looks, I'll go along with this because it's good for the nation. Okay? I bet you that they will take that. They will accept that. And vice versa. Because that's the only way that it will work. And I think we, or at least, not, you don't have to do a thing. This is what I'm doing. You can only change yourself. You can only do what you can. And I want to thank you for your attention. And if you have any questions, I'll read below otherwise. Thank you very much.
The thing we'd like to do is to either direct questions to guests on and or people feel free to, for those who may have also been here, because I have no idea who's here, in terms of some of the people or who know people, please feel free to share. There's just one thing I've always been curious about, and each story I'm sure is different, but the how you got to the U.S.
Okay. All right. I'll tell you the story. I'm not going to act it out. No, it's not a pantomime. Although I could do that too, or would love to. Anyway, I want you to know that you're the first group outside my close friends who I ever told my story to, because it is a personal story. It's a very traumatic thing, but it's amazing how similar my story is to thousands of others. And I, for years, I thought I was really unique until I read books by people who talked about doing this and doing that, and we did the same thing. And I said, oh my God, you know, they did the same thing. But anyway, I'll give you the bare minimum of things. My parents were divorced. I left with my mother, okay? By the way, it was a joint decision to go. My mother, at the age of 12, gave me the power to say yes or no, and would not give me a guilt trip if I said no. In other words, if I wanted to stay here. But I didn't want to stay here because I didn't want to take my tests in eighth grade. You know, I already had chemistry, physics, whatever, and I hated chemistry, and I didn't want to study for my matriculation. You know, so I wanted to leave. But anyway, so somehow we managed to find, we hooked up with this farmer, actually he was a rancher, who would guide us across, but we still had to get to the border. And my mother had this idea, she was an incredible woman, that we should, if we get to Sopron, which is near the border of Austria, we needed a reason to go to Sopron. We couldn't, you know, if somebody checks our papers, he said, why are you going to Sopron, you know? So I used to, believe it or not, be interested in dramatics. But I was always in the school plays and things like that, and recital, poetry recital, everything. And I had a wonderful head of my school. And I went to him, and I said, we said, you know, we would like to visit the art school, acting school, the acting school in Sopron. So he said, okay, I'll give you, on the letterhead, please see that Gaston Bedaz is visiting such and such a school to try out for a play. I mean, that was a stretch, but still. So we had this paper. So we had a reason to go to Sopron. But my mother said, no, we're going to get off just before Sopron, because it stopped at every little village, and we're going to change trains and go backwards, and then that's where the guy met us. Now, the tactic here was very smart because nobody checked papers going backwards, back toward Hungary. Mm-hmm. And we managed somehow on this bus that took us all the way to that spot. At any rate, we take this train one stop. And
train or bus?
Train. This was train. We take this train one stop, and the train stops, and it's 9 o'clock at night, pitch black. And you know, you get off, and you know how tall these things, and you have to step down and you hand it down.
What time of the year is this?
This is December 24th.
21st.
No. No, excuse me, December 20th, because we crossed on the 21st. This was 20th. So we sat down, and as soon as we were down, I mean, no one else was getting down from off the train. The train, you know, pulls out, and we're standing there, and all you hear is, like, nothing, and it's pitch black. And all of a sudden, I hear a horse's. So we sort of saw this horse and buggy, and this guy sitting on the horse. And we had a code that we asked them, "What is the? I don't know what it was. What's the temperature in Sofia or something?" He said 23, and we were going. So he says, "Dad, you're the next step." Anyway, we get up on this buggy, and we start going. And about a half hour later, you know, I mean, this is a very bumpy ride, and we're just absolutely petrified. And all of a sudden, we smelled something absolutely terrible. Well, it was sheep shit, because they were sheep farmers. So you smell the dung from the sheep, so we knew we were getting close to his house. And there was one light bulb. Yeah.
Was it just you and your mother?
Me and my mother.
Your brother?
No, my brother came a month before. See, okay. My brother was in medical school, and he left a month earlier with his whole class.
And was living with Esther's family.
Esther's family in London by the time we crossed the border. And he didn't know we were coming out, because we couldn't communicate.
And how did an entire class receive the permission?
There is no permission. They escaped.
They escaped?
We
that
all
many
escaped.
People at one time?
200,000 people escaped altogether, but they came in groups. You know, they could be one class of people from one student class, or they could be neighbors. Or we ended up, when we came to this farm, the owner waited for the following day to collect at least 10 people. So we had 10 people, two babies. They gave some aspirins to the babies so that they would sleep, because they didn't want them to make noise. And the evening of the 21st was the day that we ended up crossing, which, by the way, is the longest day of the year, and it's Stalin's birthday. Which is the darkest day of the year is Stalin's birthday. It's very appropriate. So I didn't make it up. It's true.
You left out something important. That your mother was able to sell your apartment.
Why is that important to them?
Well, because it's important because of what happens next. You had cash.
Oh. Well, we had some cash because my mother was bright enough to somehow sell our apartment. And so, how do you carry cash? You put in each pocket. You put 1,000 forints. Now, 1,000 forints. You have to remember that in those days, my father made maybe 600 forints a month, if that, and that was with pay. If he made it, you know. So, we had this money in our pocket, but that's not the essence of the story. The thing is it was. The evening of the 21st, and there were 10 of us together. So we got up all on the buckboard on this wagon, and the owner's son, who was our guide, was driving. And then after about a half hour, 45 minutes of going, he stopped and says, "We get out here." So we all got off. He turned around and went back to the farm, and there we were with a guide, with 10 people, two babies. And we turned that direction, and he got us all together, and he said, "Look, if a light rocket goes up, you know, one of these flares, you hit the ground because they can see your shadow." So we started walking, and you know, you walk, and we each had, my mother and I both had two bags, just like every refugee you've ever seen, you know, walking. And you get tired, and in order not to carry so much, we wore at least 3 or 4 layers of clothing.
so that you carry less. It's on your body. But that meant that we were sweating like crazy. We were really getting tired. So a rocket goes up and we hit the ground. I mean, a flare to get up. Then all of a sudden, the earth changed. It was what we used to call in Hungarian double plowed, deep plowed earth. And they purposefully deep plowed it because there were rocks in the ground about that deep. So, and it's pitch black, so every second step you fall down. So all you're doing is you're standing up, walking a few steps, falling down, then the flare goes up, you hit the ground. So after about an hour or so of this, you are exhausted. So then one of the babies started crying. So the father almost choked the baby. They put their hand on the baby's thing, and then they administered some more aspirin, and da-da-da, the kid fell asleep, we walked on. Then my mother and I were debating at one point whether to drop one of the bags, because it was just, I mean, we were exhausted. So we decided, no, we can't drop it. We brought it this far, we're going to bring it further. So this goes on. Then we started out at 9 o'clock, and now it's around midnight, 12:30, and the guide stops and said, okay, if you can, you see that light over there? He says, that's Austria. Wow. You know, everybody was just... And then there's going to be a line, a dark strip, that's really finely graded. I'd like you to go single file and walk in each other's footsteps. And because I don't want the guards in the morning to see how many people cross, because then they can sort of figure out where they came from, maybe, or whatever. So, and that, you know, we were like really exhausted at this point. So he said, I will walk with you for another mile or so, and then I will return, and you just go toward the blue light. The light in the distance had a blue tinge to it. The light bulbs were different in the west than this. And so we said goodbye to him, he goes back, and we trudge on, and all of a sudden we see two bodies in front of us with machine guns. And everyone, you know, I mean, they just freeze. And with perfect Hungarian, the guy says, are you refugees? So we said, yes. And he said, welcome to Austria. They were Austrian soldiers. So we went to the ground, and we kissed the ground. And we were free. We were free. And, you know, each with two bags, and extremely lucky. You know, we ran into a former partner of my father's in the pre-war, in that village of Deutschkreuz, who recognized me because I looked just like my father, and went up and said, "What has Geza, Geza, Geza?" And my mother pulls me away. Now, what does this man want with my son? You know. And he started saying that I am so and so. I am the partner of Gaze. I was the partner. He was the partner who ran out of my father. But anyway, but at that point it didn't matter. And he was very, very nice. And he and a friend of his were on their way to Vienna. And he exchanged 100 shillings. What the Hungarian money worth for nothing? And it was a gift. He gave us 100 shillings. And he brought us, he said, take us to a hotel that, so he took us to the Hotel Regina, and my mother goes into the hotel, and she spoke German fluently and said, "Guten Abend, how much is one night?" He said, 100 shillings. She said, no problem. She took out, gave the 100 shillings, we go upstairs, she gets on the telephone, calls this businessman friend who she knew from before the war, and makes arrangements for him to come to the hotel the following day. And with him, he makes who had a mother living in Budapest. He was a Hungarian living in Austria. He was a ballpoint manufacturer. So the guy says, so my mother said, you know, we sold our apartment in Budapest. We could get foreigns given to your mother if you can get, if you give me shillings here. He says, Valerie, whatever you want. He remembered how gorgeous my mother was in her youth, you know, and she said, Valerie, whatever you want. Yeah. So, and this, for a kid, and you have to realize what happened. You know, the guy takes out a briftashi. Now, this is not a little crap like this. He takes out this thing that opens up like this, like a, you know, beautiful leather, like a tan leather. And I'll never forget the cream colored leather. And goes like this. And goes, and keeps counting hundreds. Okay, I mean, he had a wad like that. And he hands it to my mother and said, great, you know, welcome, and, you know, if I can be of any other help, tell me, and so on. And, you know, these are those things that happen, not out of the clear blue, because still, my mother had to have met this guy under certain circumstances in Budapest. The fact that she managed to sell the apartment, the fact that we had some money left behind in Hungary that we could give to somebody else, whose relative was able to give us shillings, and just, you know, amazing coincidence. So anyway, how we got to America was that we didn't know where we were going to go. My mother interviewed everybody that she knew. The clean lady, the waiter, the people in the thing. She says, okay, if we go to Germany in 5 years, what would we have? So they said, well, you know, you might have a job, a furnished apartment, and this, that, and the other thing. And anyway, we also, by that time, had some family come to America, and we had someone who was willing to sponsor us, and the IRC, the International Rescue Committee, gave us we got on their quota, and they gave us you got a one-way trip to the U.S., to most of the countries that took you in. And the only problem was that my brother was in London now, not realizing that we escaped. So we called him on the phone, and he was totally confused because he thought we were in Budapest, and we were in Vienna. So now we wanted to be together. So now he had to. He ended up crossing the Austrian border from Germany illegally, walked across the border to come back to meet us. So he was there the second time without any right to be there at all. And we got in to see the American ambassador. And when we told the story that my brother had to come back from England illegally, he says, that is the most goddamn unbelievable story I ever heard. A family that wants to be together like that. He says, listen, Gaston, he says, you love America. They have great milk there.
I hated milk because I always had milk that was warm. I hate it. Now I love ice cold milk. Thank you, America. Ice cold milk. So we were all together. He gave my brother an auxiliary number, and then we were taken to Salzburg, where they collected 2,000 Hungarians. Who were then put on a train, and this time not to go to Auschwitz, but to go to Bremenhaven, and there we got on a World War I troop carrier called General Nelson Walker, a 17,000-ton troop carrier, which is yet another story. And then we got to the United States February 14th, and we saw the Statue of Liberty, and I can't tell you what that felt like. It was just, it was heaven. It was heaven. And then you have to learn the language. Not easy. I, you, I am, you are, he is, we are, you are, they are, and I knew the word sheet. It's not enough to get you anywhere. but I think my life has been a continuous string of miracles, in one sense, that everything contributes to, that everything and everybody contributes to, and I don't know. Any other questions? Because I'll talk on that.
What happened with your father? Sorry.
My father
did not want to come out. First of all, my parents were divorced 2 years before the revolution. He remarried a younger woman. and got incredibly fat. And we came back to visit him a number of times. I mean, he was absolutely... How would you describe it?
Extremely dramatic.
Dramatic.
Very... Do you remember him?
Yes, no.
Imposing kind of person.
Yeah. He was incredible. He would never show up without a rose or a... Very romantic. And
women loved him.
Yeah, even though he was fat by that time. So I have a ways to go, though. But my father didn't come out. He stayed here, and he ended up dying here also.
Yeah. I was curious, I know these things are hard to talk about, but you just referred to the Hungarian soul, and I'm curious just some of the associations you have with that. Let's say compare it to the, quote, American soul, for example.
I'm not talking about the American soul like that, okay? Not like soul music and soul, you know, that's nothing wrong with it.
Yeah, no, I was just pointing at you and saying, he can tell you about that. But, no, Hungarian soul, that's a very, comparison of Hungarian and American soul. There is something about the weight of historical events that influences people. And Americans talk about being in war right now. And the war that happened in the United States was that two big fucking buildings fell down and 2,000 people died. I am not saying that that's a small thing, but that was the reason why there is a war. But everyone still is getting fatter from McDonald's and no one changed their lives. Nothing changed in America that would indicate what war is. In Europe, we lived through wars. After we came out of the building, after November 3rd, I saw a soldier, I don't even know whether it was a soldier or not, but, a dead body with the top of his head off, nothing inside his head, with like this white powdery substance, and the bones were sort of, he looked like a puppet. You couldn't even tell where his legs started and ended up inside his pants, okay? You see things like that. Where does Hungarian soul come from? It's from tradition, it's from songs, from passion, from listen to the Megbűnhött te már a nép a múltat és a jövendőt. We're already expecting tragedy in the future, my God, the Hungarian folk songs, we cry and laugh at the same time. Americans don't cry and laugh at the same time. They don't. It's not part of their being. It is a melting pot. And it's a wonderful place in a lot of respects. Hungary, the Hungarian soul, and I keep having to come back to trying to answer your question, I think it is steeped in history a little bit deeper than, or in different way than the American. But at the same time, I don't want to sound like I'm so down on the America gave a home and a future to millions and millions and millions of people. And Hungary has also contributed enormously to education, to science, and so on. An industry, my God. I mean, it's a fabulous fertile ground for this kind of growth, okay? But there's a tragedy here that's part of that Hungarian soul. I'm not a tragic Hungarian. But I do have that feeling that I get emotional about the earth. The earth. There's something about owning a piece of land that I don't know whether Americans really, that it's part of, I think, what the soul. I never thought of this question before, so I'm sort of grappling with it now. But I would, when in America, when I There also, I took the same love of Glenn there, but I think maybe it's more of a real estate question there than, okay? So I think maybe the differences are there. The fact that, you know, I went into my office after Clinton was found with Monica Lewinsky, and, you know, the thing blew up like crazy, and, it didn't blow up again. But my colleagues, all these women, say, yes, no, so what? So he's screwed, you know, big deal. I say, yeah, but he's married. He goes, that's not that big a deal. So, but that's lifestyle, that's not soul. But I digress. Any other questions?
You mentioned that you felt that the recent events had affected your willing to feel again this 56 in the 50th anniversary. I would like to know why, and especially what things do you think are these things stealing your
okay.
Memory.
Very, very good. I purposely didn't digress then, but first I'll tell you what gave me satisfaction, partially. What gave me satisfaction was out of nowhere, we got an invitation from the Canadian embassy to attend the celebration and to honor the memory of 1956 that was a concert at the Nuvese Etekpolataya on a few days after 23rd, I think.
No,
The 21st of and it was a fantastic thing because they showed a lot of visuals where people would talk. It was as if they filmed me and they would say, what was your experience going there? What did you achieve? What did, you know, and all these people were giving homage, giving thanks to Canada. Of the 40,000 who Canada took in, some of these people were were interviewed. And there was some wonderful music. There was a Canadian folk singer, pop jazz singer, who entertained us and so on. But this, the fact that there was a country that was very much like America in a lot of respects, who gave honor to me, to all of us who were trying to remember 1956. What, since you asked the question, I'm going to tell you the reason I feel that this was hijacked from me was that for certain reasons of Hungarian law and opportunities for different groups to take advantage of loopholes or opportunities to gather in public places, knowing these groups, knowing that the country wanted to put a good face on this thing and honor the revolution, and they were stopped at the parliament because they put up a beer tent and they were urinating over there and selling popcorn and all this crap, and it had nothing to do with 1956. And even Horváth János, who was the youngest member of parliament before the revolution, between the two wars, I mean, not before, after the Second World War, he was the youngest, who is now a Fidesz parliamentary, an 80-some-odd-year-old guy. He also came out and said, oh yes, it's like 1956, you know. It had nothing to do with 1956, what's happening now. Absolutely nothing. It's just an opportunity to take the emotional vulnerability of people and make them into a tool of something that has nothing to do with that memory. Absolutely nothing. That was a revolution. This is a political manipulation of the legal system of a country. Anyway, that's my point. So anyway, that's why I think that has been hijacked. And now November 4th, okay, when the Russians came back in, when they blew the city to pieces, okay, in November 4th, 1956, surrounded the city. I fell out of bed at 4 a.m. in the morning. We looked out the window, and the entire circle of, you know, the horizon was red, pulsating red. We grabbed our mattresses, ran down to the basement. And now, after what happened here during the past weeks, the irresponsibility of bringing people out on the street and having a torch parade, for heaven's sakes, a torch parade, and then saying that no, and keep the police in the barracks. Now, thank you very much, but no thank you. Okay? I want the police out there. Not that the police were not guilty of excesses. I have friends who were beaten up with nothing to do with the demonstrations and cruelly beaten up by the police or whoever they were in uniforms. But that's not the point here. The point is that we cannot allow, not allow, what's it, we cannot. I'm getting into the same. I think it would be wrong not to have police protection at a public event where people are going to walk down with lit torches, you know, on that sheet, and walk over to the Astoria again. I mean,
is that what they're planning?
No, they want to go from the Terror House to the Astoria, whatever they want to do. Yeah, Terror House to the Astoria, I think, mm-hmm. without police presence. So, anyway, those things have nothing to do with 1956. 1956 was against Russian occupational communist oppression of dictatorial regime. That was what that was about. We have now an elected government. Whether someone likes it or not, it was elected. They lied. They were elected. And grin and bear it and get elected yourself 2 years from now. But until then, go to the parliament, discuss the possibilities, don't go out on the street and ruin our lives. We can't walk outside because someone wants to protest. Protest, but you know, don't say that you're doing this because of what happened in 1956. It has nothing to do with it. Was I firm enough on that?
Yeah.
Anything else?
How many other people in this room?
Good question.
Here in 1956. No.
Anybody here?
Who was born after 1956?
Am I that old? Holy shit! Oh, yeah. Oh, you were born after. What do you think about? What do you know about the revolution? What are your feelings about? How do you see it in the 56? What do you know about it?
I'm just trying to learn it.
Okay.
And I find that I find Hungarian politics. I love learning politics, and I love learning in other countries' politics. I've been here for 15 months, and I'm trying to understand it. Hungarian politics is not like anything I've ever seen. It seems opposite. Left seems right, right seems left, but then left isn't left, and right isn't right. I don't know what is going on half the time. And
ask me.
Especially since the riots began, and so on, and my neighborhood is a war zone. I don't know what to think. My sympathies are always with rioters, and now I'm not sure if I want to have sympathies with them at all. And I'm not very confused.
No, that's good.
You can ask him about 1956.
What about 1956? I'm sorry. Yeah, please.
Yeah, my name is Zsuzsa Pienes, and I was here in the country in 1956, although I was younger than yourself. I was too young to be running around in the streets, but your story actually triggered a lot of feeling memories, because I was like your family, sitting in a basement in Élmekásfér, which is today Leheltér, in District 13, and feeling terrified. Not exactly knowing, I mean not knowing at all why. One reason why was because my parents weren't there, with me. I was with people, neighbors, who lived in the apartment building, and it was just very well. It's all connected with also what you've said about the Hungarian soul. I mean, my family. My parents have always been, well, my mother's dead now, but they were true believers in communism and social justice. Our family is Jewish, and not usually not that many people know what it meant to live in Hungary in under the Horthy regime and being dirt poor and not being able to afford to pay for a tram ticket, and not only not being able not just to rent an apartment, just like rent a bed for the night with your family, and then be persecuted and be on the run for your life. And so all of these things, I mean, 1956 is, I think, something that I don't even like to think about because I was too young for the politics, but on the one hand, but my family was too engaged in the whole history, or willingly or unwillingly, that nobody really ever dealt with it. My parents actually were, my mother who was a doctor, she was a member of the communist youth. I don't know what it was called, but like a student movement.
Pioneers?
No, not the pioneers.
No, Kiss.
No, not the, yeah, Deeps maybe, but anyway, at the hospital where she worked, she was one of the people who was a leader in that movement. So in 1956, as she told me later, she was kicked out by the Revolutionary Committee at the Egyetem Belklinika, that's the teaching hospital for internal medicine of Shota University today. And she was out, as I learned later, looking for food for me. And my father, who was in military intelligence, he was in his barracks, and God knows, I don't even know what he did, because like a true intelligence person, officer, he's never said a word about any of it, for the most part. And so, you know, just all these issues coming up of what they were doing and what were they thinking, and then all mixed up with their being, just hating religion and race and becoming Bolshevik internationalists, but what happened, how did Hungary become this Stalinist regime, and what they knew and they didn't know, and you know, all these things, and it's so much more complex and painful than I feel a lot of anger when people laugh at communists in these old, you know, when we talk about these things, and it's all bad, and you know, you were the wicked guys and the others were the good guys, and you know, just like you said, everything is a blur, and I think what's most painful for me is that, I mean, I don't really identify as a Hungarian or a Jew, or I've lived in three different countries myself, but I feel that if I say we as Hungarians have never really faced the past, what we as human beings did, not just our governments in 1944 or in 19, you know, whenever, it's taking responsibility. And I think a lot of the pain comes from not having taken responsibility for, you know, without knowing what happened in the 30s, the 40s, in 1944, 45, or knowing the geopolitical context, you can't really know what was going on here. And it's just a lot of, I'm just saying, you know, verbalizing a lot of it, but it's mostly the feelings of the pain of ruined family lives. And on the other hand, I really appreciate your personal story. I feel like I was really able to hear it, even though I felt a lot of emotional resistance to it. But I don't have that kind of cathartic story to tell, even though, like, I've spent the last 7 years in the United States, but I didn't get there like you did. So, and it's changed my life as well, for the better, for the most part. But I think it's so interesting to talk more openly about these issues and going beyond the cliches and the stereotypes. I think what Hungary really needs a big dose of what German people went through after World War II. And I think after having lived for 15 years in informal democracy, I think it's time to be liberated from within. I think that's the next. I think without that, there will not be catharsis or happiness.
I totally agree.
Here, anyway. I'm sorry to have
wonderful.
Dogs.
No, wonderful.
Tell about your own family with that.
I really appreciate the opportunities.
I want to thank you, Georgia, because I've been living here since 1992, and I've been coming here during the communist period. I was married to a Hungarian man, and so I had the opportunity to come here since 1984. And since beginning to live here, I've had so many different kinds of experiences of people who mention the word socialist and immediately they think communist. And it is, how do you say, it is what you were describing as something which is so confusing for a lot of people who, let's say, maybe didn't have a family background I went into or stepped into. But it does seem that this country desperately needs, and I don't see it, don't feel it's going to happen, but like, you know, what they have in South Africa, which is a commission for truth and reconciliation, because I've met people who are so angry at each other, you know, and really they make the same equivalent to communism and socialism, and if you say something, look, but there are socialist countries all over Western Europe. Oh, no, but here it's the same, it's absolutely the same, it's the same guys, and they're all billionaires, and the this and that, and then the SDS are all Jews, and they're on, in fact it's not, but, you know, all these things are very mixed up and confused, and it would be wonderful to have that kind.
You know, you hit on something that I don't want to dominate the conversation anymore, but just one more comment. When you mentioned truth and reconciliation, I feel that it's exactly what's needed, and I'll bring
not only in Hungary.
Not only in Hungary, but there's a very specific example. One of the ways that Gyurcsány has been attacked was that he married a woman whose father was a very important communist.
Grandfather.
Give me a break.
Sure.
It has nothing to do with the man today. Attack the man for what he is. Maybe his nose is too big or something. Tell him, say something about that. But the wife's grandfather was a communist, and because of that I should hate him, or I dislike him, or I should... that's the problem. Because then we go back to where Kosovo is, that the 1300s, somebody raped my cousin, and I'm going to kill everybody who looks just like that person in 1300 who raped that cousin. We have to let go and go beyond. Yes.
If I may add to some of the confusion that's implicit in history as well as in your circumstances, what's been mentioned here about a Hebrew woman who's caught in one side to be on, because one side, after having two Nazi fascists, occupation, or the time when you were in New York in 1956, or not New York, in the United States, there was a gentleman who was elected under the democratic system by the name of Eugene McCarthy, sir. And he...
Are you talking about Joseph McCarthy?
I'm sorry. Eugene McCarthy was my boy.
Joseph McCarthy. Yeah, McCarthy. No, Malcolm McCarthy.
He was the one, as you know,
right,
at 56, when you were having your spontaneous liberation, he was having a manipulative,
you got it,
destructive, incisive surgery into democracy by calling everybody or those people who are vulnerable communists.
You're
and
right.
Destroying
their lives.
Many lives.
You're absolutely right. These are those parallels that are really important. That's a wonderful point that you brought up. Because
where's the growing edge in Hungary now? I mean, where is the, is there someplace the energy for anything like truth and reconciliation? Is there anything like an inclination to address the 30s, the 40s, and what's happened since? Does that exist here?
No.
No, I think the first sense of admission that Hungarians had something to do with the Holocaust, the fact that they played into the hands of the Nazis. I mean, the Nazis didn't go into Kiskunhuba Harcsak and find out who was Jewish or not. They were handed the Jews just like this.
Yes.
And that's only a recent history that happened, okay? But the fact that we as Hungarians or Hungarians must recognize that there are other sides to the story. But what was your question?
Where's the growing edge?
Oh, the growing edge?
How do you get from there to a greater sense of openness? Where, I mean, you don't stop blaming until there's a recognition. You know, whoever said, what happened in Germany after the war, that was really significant. I mean, Germans.
It's the youth. The youth. The young people, there are some common threads here that are tied to technology, which is a computer. You go to a Hungarian and say, let's enter, because it's written on her enter, the word enter. Small thing, but there are universal languages being developed. I think that part of what I see is I've had phenomenally wonderful young people work for me, Hungarians here. I know so many vibrant, intelligent, worldly thinking, really good. And then there are some young people who still have their fathers or their parents. Well, we can't really do this, instead of saying, let me find a way to do it. That's the difference, okay? That is the edge. Is the more people realize that they have the solution to a problem. It could be a very simple problem. How to clean up dog shit or anything. I mean, it doesn't have to be all big world issues. But that's where it's at. It's the positive thing.
But I also think it's very important to say that, I don't know what the word you use, the edge or whatever, that yeah. There is a handful of institutes containing researchers who are grappling with these things all the time, and if you look at certain television programs late in the evening, there are certain very refreshingly open-minded intellectuals, if you like, who are grappling with this stuff. I mean, one institute is the Institute for 1956, where a guy has just brought out a book on what happened in Köztársaság tér, where they attacked the Communist Party headquarters and the lynchings took place. Uh-huh. A book just on that, and he's written many books about 56. There's a new institute, Christina, the Institute for Democratic Transition, who are putting together an oral history about what happened in 1989 and what didn't happen in 1989. So, it's not true to say that there are no efforts, there is no thinking, there is no, there are small groups of people who are grappling with this stuff and who feel just, Hungarians, who feel just as horrified as we do, more so because they're more affected, you know.
Yeah,
I mean, as, you know, most of the people in this room are, you could say, non-Hungarian, you know, they're not as affected by the disgrace of what happened on October the 23rd, you know, the shame of it, which is the headline on this newspaper, 168 hours, you know. These are the germs of what you're talking about, I think, and yeah, they do exist.
I didn't mean to suggest they didn't. I was really asking a question.
Well, I mean, that's where I see them. I don't know if somebody else sees them somewhere else.
But I also teach a class in cross-cultural communication to Hungarian undergraduates. And in one semester, faced a class that said to me that among the Hungarian Nobel laureates who all left Hungary, that Kertész, who had just won the Nobel Prize, was not really Hungarian.
Why? Because he's Jewish?
They didn't say that. Mm-hmm. They didn't say that. When I asked if that was the case, they said, oh, no, no, it has nothing to do with that. So what makes him not Hungarian? I never got an answer, but, you know, that is also part of this substrata.
Well, that's just that kind of horror that Orban and his people have introduced these euphemisms, you know, so that you're cosmopolitan instead of being Jewish, or right, you're whatever, you know, word they use, which is just straight anti-Semitism, you know, and it has to be dealt with as such. I mean,
is cosmopolitan a bad word?
And for Hungarians, yes, it is.
Well, it's a euphemism. It's
an artificially created substitute word to mean that. Okay. But there are tons of these around. I mean, words that are being used. They're code words.
I'd like to add, because I've been thinking, listening to all of this, and I'd like to add my thoughts about the difference between the Hungarian soul and the American soul, and I'm not quite sure that the soul is the right phrase or word for it, but certainly attitude is. And I think that if I were to oversimplify, which you know is dangerous, then I would say that there's something dark and melancholy about the Hungarian soul, and that there is, and Hungarians are rather almost proud of this as well. I mean, it's cultivated. And that on the American side, that there's what in the extreme is in American lingo is called a Pollyanna, you know, always smiling, lightness and positiveness, which to the Hungarian melancholy is a joke, you know, that all of American films have to have a happy ending. And I heard a joke recently about a man was very depressed and in London or England or whatever, and went to his psychiatrist, and his parting words were, and do not see any Hungarian films. So that's on the one hand. But I would also say that somehow psychologically deeper than that, that there is very much a belief and an acceptance of Hungarians as being victims throughout history. And I think that there's validity to that, because I think Hungarian history has been very tragic. And I think it has, from its very beginnings, I mean, Hungary has not ever been free except for those few days in 1956 until 89. And yet, the tribe, the nation, the race, whatever, has survived 1,100 years. But there is a victim mentality, and I'm one of those with Gaston that have always said that the Hungarian national anthem is a dreadfully negative brainwashing experience.
I always cry when I sing it.
Well, what else can you do? And it's that we are victims, we've been victims, and, you know, the carry-on from that is, and we shall always remain victims. And if you keep repeating this, then indeed it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. So I think that the victim attitude is very deep in Hungarian consciousness, and that is not the case in the U.S. And then the other thing I'd like to add is that because, in my opinion, because of the victim mentality and because of history, it has become, the historical experience, it has become very easy for Hungarians and very convenient to place the blame on some outside influence, on some outside power, on some outside occupational dictatorship, which in fact Hungary has endured for 1100 years. So there is validity here for the premise that we are out of control and the blame is on this outside force. Now the big existential question is that right now we have no one to blame but ourselves for the situation that we have gotten into. And this is a very new experience for the Hungarian psyche. Yeah. And Hungarians are not willing to own up to admitting culpability or taking blame or accepting responsibility, and this was definitely forbidden during the last 40 years and two generations of communist rule, because if you took the initiative, you could lose your job, you could lose your freedom, you could get in trouble. So the whole idea of taking initiative and taking responsibility and blame for actions, whether it's political or just immediately in our own circle, is a new experience for the Hungarian psyche, because the way I've been living here temporarily, I've been saying this for 16 years, I think for 3 months, but I also am myself a 56 who left. I was too young to be out there fighting, and the most I could do is draw tanks, you know, in the basement because it was so boring. But I grew up in the U.S., and in psychological terms, what I have always described the transition psychologically for Hungary to have been coming out of an abusive relationship, essentially. And so finding, for Hungary to find its identity is a very fragile and difficult process. And having this dual vision of being, I always say 100% Hungarian, I'm 100% American, I really do see that on my good days, democracy here is only 60 years old, and we in the U.S. have been perfecting it for over 200, to take a deep breath and take a step back and try not to get into rabid arguments with the news and the television and what's going on, and then just say, you know, calm down. It'll take several generations for this country to even begin to think in democratic terms. And I also agree that the only hope is in the young people, who, given proper guidance, like Burns' teaching from another perspective, will begin to think in terms of the responsibility begins with me, the grassroots action, that democracy is in my own hands. It's not Gyurcsány, it's not Orbán, it's me. And it's my right to vote, and it's
my right to go to Afghanistan, for example.
or whatever. It begins with the person. And that very deeply felt experience of democracy, which every American takes for granted, is not even conceptual here yet, in my opinion, mm-hmm. and in my observation. Mm-hmm. Anyway, end of my story.
I'm American, and your definition about not using soul is interesting to me because I'm perplexed. I've been here a very short time. What will happen, can you project, can anyone prophesy, project, or muse about it, when American culture starts to inhabit these streets that are ancient and full of victimization and full of beauty and high points in culture and refinements? What is going to happen to these streets when the graffiti starts to climb the walls and the rock and rollers start to wear their jeans below their behinds? What's going to start to happen when world trade now becomes an issue of what are you going to put into it and what is it going to do back to you? What about the, you can't think in a void. You can't. Hamlet is in 1600. He's the victim. He can't make up his mind. You're in his position. No. Too much is accelerating too quickly. And I see on these streets already, and I've traveled Europe with an open arm, American culture, which I'm not going to judge. <It's>
okay.
There's the culturalist. Starts to crawl on its tiny cat paws, rock and rolling through your palace, your gorgeous palace, and your gorgeous parliament, and your marvelous river when they start skinny dipping.
I always say that I came here in 91. This is my own obvious, idiocy was I had never heard of Michael Jackson, actually, as of 1991.
And you were not a child.
I discovered Michael Jackson in Budapest in her son's room, and I found Vanilla Ice in the other room. I never heard of either of these gentlemen. And I would say that if I had to predict, the future of Hungary, I think it's already well on the track to becoming EU-ized, globalized, global culture, global trash, whatever you want to call it. Culture trash. I mean, that's what I see among the young people. The thing that hit me today, because it's just interesting, but I'm always struck, as we talk about how the young people in Hungary don't know their own history. It just seems that's so true everywhere, isn't it?
And
other than maybe Germany. I went back to Laos, and the young people in Laos don't know about how the Americans invaded their country and bombed them. Mm-hmm. Not to mention America. America is the most ahistorical country on earth. I've just been amazed looking. I was very involved in Vietnam, just looking at how absolutely right down. I could give a talk right now for 10 hours about this. How we're repeating the exact same. The U.S. government, I should say, is repeating the exact same mistakes they made in Vietnam. I mean, forgetting about wrong or right or anything, it's just incredible.
Amazing.
That they didn't learn a thing from that unbelievably long war. There's no history, and I just. My sense of things is I think history affects people on a psychic level and has a huge impact on soul and all that. But if I had to predict, let's say, where Hungary's going to be 20 years from now, I'd be surprised if it doesn't look a lot like the rest of Europe. I could be wrong.
Mm-hmm. I would say a couple of things, if I could, particularly just starting there. Some of you know that Colin and I, as we said yesterday, in fact, just got back from a week-long trip to Jordan, where I had been invited to speak at a UN a university program on nonviolence. The significance to me of it is that there were people there from Israel, from Palestine, from Iraq, from Jordan, of course, from the people from Lebanon that used to come, because of the Israeli, but the Syria and other Islamic countries in Asia, without going through the entire array of countries. And I mean that it was just that we're still processing the meeting, because I mean we just got back like yesterday from like after a week there, a very intense week. And my initial thought of, you know, talking about nonviolence in that environment, which is ridiculous, right? but as it turned out, though, it really wasn't. I mean, of the Israeli participants, by the way, there were three rabbis, along with intense Israeli peace activists, intense Palestinian peace activists, outside the meetings. The things were just so fluid that you never saw any kind of ethnic pockets or cliques. I mean, people just related to people. Now, in the meeting, I mean, the thing that I found so striking was how things could be going along so well, and an Israeli might say something about some historical point, and it would just like be off to the races, or a Palestinian would say something. I mean, I was just so stunned. It could be something that happened yesterday or 200 years ago or 2,000 years ago, and, for that matter. As the one who spent a significant time during the war in Yugoslavia, I was in Bosnia during the war and in the Macedonian refugee camps during the bombing of Syria and so forth, that like I've often said, half joking, half serious, in terms of the U.S., because that's always criticize the U.S. for the fact that we don't know history, and so that and say how bad that was, and then being in parts of former Yugoslavia where you could find an illiterate alcoholic on a corner somewhere in Skopje, and they can tell you 1,000 years of history. But it was a particular focus on history. Mm-hmm. It wasn't. And the thing that I hopefully saw very hopefully in the Israeli-Palestinian context is that there was a group of Israelis and Palestinians who have a shared history project where they're looking at that history. I don't want to talk about that right now, but to say that I think that is important in terms of history, that when we look at it, my daughter, who is a staunch feminist, talks about it as history, not her history, but his history. That's one aspect of it, though, that's very real. But also the aspect that people have got different bents on history, so that I think that you know, our truth and reconciliation has to come in context, I think, of some sort of shared historical understanding of events, because we all, you know, that, like, I just imagine, because clearly, as an African-American, I know my view of history is different from a significant amount of white Americans, and then we have our Native Americans who, you know, who see all of us in a particular context of U.S. history, so that's just one thing I just want to mention, that it's not just history, it's not the solution, but it is how we look at history, the approach that we take, I think, is part of that aspect of that solution. The thing about Jordan that just thoroughly surprised me, even though I've been to Jordan once before, but my experience was caught up in a staff meeting in a hotel, so I didn't see much. But I mean, there's more encroachment of the U.S. commercial culture there than anything I've seen here. I mean,
really?
They don't just have KFC, they have Popeyes. I mean, they have the Colonel is just everywhere, really. I mean, 24-hour KFC, 24-hour McDonald's.
Wow.
And I mean, spread out. You don't have to go to a part of town. And I was just struck in the context of being in the Middle East that was the case, and I say it just to say it because I do think it's tragic. Also, I mean, the thing that most Americans I know love about Hungary is that they have this beautiful architectural infrastructure that's just, I mean, mm-hmm. for me, it's just a treat to walk down the streets every single day mm-hmm. that I'm here. And
it's not going to disappear.
Yeah, but that's what I'm worried about. Because I'm thinking, like, oh, man, is this going to be a parking lot one day? You know, it's my thought looking at the U.S. Yeah. But, so that's just, those are just some comments. Two other things I just want to say, and, like, I don't want to break the meeting up, but I do want to just flag two things. One thing before people go, there are... How many people here who heard about this through a friend who was also here or me, that for those who we don't have their email address, please, please make sure that we have your email address before you leave. We try to do these once a month. I don't know what's going to happen because of the holidays in December. I'm sure we're going to have a party, by the way. So, but in terms of a formal meeting, I don't know. But please, please, make sure we have your email before you go, and then I'll turn my
presentation. Just for those of you who didn't see, I put a little pad of paper for your email address. It'll be right here on the table.
And for those who do smoke, can smoke outside, by the way, because there's an ashtray. I know that there are some.
Yeah. Just a bit of perspective. When McDonald's opened in Venceslav Square in Prague, Václav Havel pointed out that Prague had definitely lived through worse.
Well, I keep thinking something you're very familiar with, Michael, omission or commission. And in the end, you know, the United States may lead the pack, so to speak, but in the end, it's people who want to take advantage of making money, and this is something that is so ingrained, whether it comes from the U.S. or any place else, the countries all over, that's why you have McDonald's, that's why you have Kentucky Fried Chicken. I think of Budapest as a suburb of New York already, and it's very disappointing because I've been here since 1984, back and forth, but on the other hand, there was also communism here, and I can't tolerate Kentucky Fried Chicken and all these other places, but I have to say that all over the world, if there are those places, it is the people of the country themselves who are taking advantage of franchises or whatever you will, you know, to live their life, you know, in a particular
Look, it's progress.
It's
no, no. The thing is that look, just as I think that the Magyar language, the Hungarian language, which is one of the richest languages in this world. I mean, I don't know those of you who are Hungarian who had a chance to read Shakespeare in English, but also read it in Hungarian. You might agree with me that Shakespeare is as rich in Hungarian as it is in English, in my opinion. It's a fabulous language. It didn't disappear. I think that as long as the laws forbid buildings to be taller in the center of the city than the basilica, I think we're somewhat safe. I think that as apartment conversions, I mean, here's an old apartment that might have had 12 people living in, you know, in three separate apartments at one time, a few regimes ago, has been fixed up and it looks great and it's a fabulous space. These things are not going to disappear. People are going to save it, and I know a lot of young people who are also going. I mean, they have to go through the stage of going to IKEA and buy the. We did the same thing in America. You buy the pressed wood furniture because that's what you could afford. Later, you find an old piece that you have it redone in Budapest, where you can still get a good repair guy to do this, that, and the other thing, and save the antiques if that's what you're into. But I think the buildings will remain. The graffiti, people are starting to have graffiti cleaning around town. There are now anti-graffiti paints that you can wash off. There is some progress, not much, but at least some people are paying attention to it.
But take off your graffiti in Paris, they sandblasted the building.
Well, now they burn the cars.
only once every 58, 68, 78.
By the way, if you
in America, they tried to do the same thing. The more they tried to deface or to take away the graffiti, the more graffiti they found, and the further out into the suburbs it went. Because you're dealing with a kind of, as this young lady said, people who want to make money, and as soon as people want to make money, you're going to go,
right.
Those who don't have it are going to start doing more than graffiti.
Excuse me a second.
She's got a question.
I know, yes. So one more question, and then we're going to break up the formal meeting, but people, please feel free to hang out as long as you can stay up. Okay, go ahead.
Well, I mean, I'm looking at everybody's comments, and it seems like you can group them into trends and into frame of mind, and, you know, thirst for education and understanding, and whether the trend is blaming McDonald's or fashion or whatever kind of, you know, movement seems to be popular at the time. I think the frame of mind and developing this frame of mind through education and understanding, whether it's people traveling or studying or like this, right, will outlast any trend, right, will outlast supposed negative effects of globalization. There's only so much you can blame on, you know, TikTok, yes, and I think it's neat because there have been lots of people who have talked about their own personal experiences and how their frame of mind, their view of the future and what will come in Hungary or the United States or the parts of Europe or the world depends on how the frame of mind is being developed. You know, looking at this stage of protest and comparing it with 56 and seeing some similarities and huge, vast differences, and how this government stays more or less stable through protests, you know, as opposed to wanting to completely overturn it. Anyways, I think that's something to focus on more than blaming if we're going to focus on taking responsibility and moving forward. You know, I think you can get dizzy turning around and pointing fingers. And so that's exciting for me. To see the institute and the educational system and people, you know, and you sharing your story and asking questions and moving forward from there. I think it's really amazing opportunity.
Well, I thank you so much. It just amazes me that how rich the opportunities are for us in this city and in every other city. And I think it's very important for people to sample these pockets of thinking and of sharing information. And we thank you for giving us the opportunity to be as open in a room full of strangers.
Thank you.
Speaking of that. I was just going to wrap things up by saying, speaking of rich opportunities in Budapest, for us, for me and Michael, having you all here is a rich opportunity for us to be able to meet and interact, and we appreciate that everybody is interested and comes and participates. So, again, with the email paper is going around, if you want to hear about future events, please put your email address on that, and we'll let you know.
And I'm going to buy some chairs, but so
and we are going to buy more chairs. We realized, I think Michael said something earlier, we realized the last time we had this many people, we had a neighbor who had lots of chairs to loan. We've realized our lack tonight. So I apologize for those of you who had to stand the whole time. But as Michael said, you know, I don't know how much food is left because y'all are a hungry bunch. But please stay and drink and eat and converse into the evening. So thank you very much.
Thank you.